Tonight on Arena, we review Sally Rooney's much-anticipated Beautiful World, Where Are You? And Tara Brady reports from the 78th Venice Film Festival. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Sally Rooney, the best-selling author of Normal People and Conversations with Friends, has been called the first great millennial novelist and Salinger for the Snapchat generation. Earlier this month, the Wall Street Journal reported that advanced copies of her latest book were selling on eBay for over $200. That book, the highly anticipated Beautiful World, Where Are You?, focuses on the friendship between Alice, a successful writer, and Eileen, an editorial assistant at a literary magazine. The women are entering their 30s and developing romantic relationships, Alice with a warehouse worker named Felix and Eileen with her childhood friend and kind of sweetheart Simon, a political advisor. Joined this evening by Mary McGill from Galway, who has been reading Beautiful World, Where Are You? I kind of looking today at stuff around Sally Rooney, Mary, and it is astonishing to think that it is only 4 years, in fact, since her debut, Conversations with Friends. I mean, stellar. Right? The rise is really, it's extraordinary. The rise to fame.
It really is. And I had to check that, Sean, today. I was like, is it really? But yes, 2017, Conversations with Friends, followed by Normal People in 2018. And of course, Normal People becoming an absolute blockbuster on the television during the pandemic. And yeah, I mean, she has become effectively a one-woman cultural phenomenon. And within that, you know, there's the huge popularity of her books that have sold in millions of copies. But there also is, you know, the kind of focus that I think makes it very difficult sometimes to separate Rooney the writer from Rooney the cultural phenomenon. And that can get you into a situation where I think it's quite unhelpful and indeed probably quite unfair on her as well. After all, she is somebody who writes and puts these books out into the world. She's not a marketer. She's not an advertiser. She's not even on social media. And yet, right from the very beginning, and I think, you know, the famous Salinger for the Snapchat generation, you know, that quote from the very beginning of her career really kind of placed her in the position, whether she wanted it or not, of acting as some kind of voice of the millennial generation, as if anyone could ever hope to speak for an entire generation. Yeah. But somehow this is a positioning that she cannot shake off. And indeed, it has intensified and it's currently at fever pitch again with the novel coming out tomorrow.
And the other thing about Sally Rooney is, you know, the minute that her name is mentioned, there will be now, and we're not talking about just good old fashioned Irish begrudgery here. We're talking about serious naysayers who just dismiss her out of hand, or certainly say, there's not much going on here, really. What's all the fuss about?
Yeah, and that's really interesting on a number of levels. You know, you'll get the criticisms of her novels that claim, well, they're just love stories. And you're like, well, yeah, that on one level they are, but many of the greatest works of art and literature have been, if you want to boil it down, simply love stories.
And if you think it's that easy off, you're going, right, just a love story.
Just a love story, indeed. And I also think, Sean, you know, we're in an age at the moment where, thanks in no small part to the media, and particularly social media, or the internet and social media, where there is this, and it's not unique to Rooney, but there's this kind of projection that happens, or this expectation that creators need to be all things to all people, which is an impossibility. It's just simply, you know, asking creators to deliver the impossible and to put them in a situation where actually, what a terrifying proposition that is if you're trying to create something. And so when you approach, you know, Rooney as a writer, you kind of need to just focus on what's on the page and ask yourself, what is here that has led millions and millions of people to read these books and to really, really identify them, and then to, you know, lead them to be adapted with the success that they have been, or at least in relation to Normal People. And I think that's probably the sanest way to go about it, because so much of the hype casts an awful lot of heat, but very little in the way of light.
Yeah, and the other thing which is added to, I suppose, in many ways, in the case of Beautiful World, Where Are You, is the fact that the two female characters here, one of whom is Alice, a hugely successful novelist, mm-hmm. who's finding it difficult to deal with the social media aspect of that, the public side of being a novelist and what's expected from a writer in that situation, and Eileen, who is an editor at a literary magazine. Now, both of these autobiographically have links to Sally Rooney's past life, past and current life, obviously.
Yes, there's a very something very meta at play here, to borrow internet parlance as it happens. And I'd like to think that maybe on some level Rooney is maybe being a bit tongue-in-cheek, a bit kind of self-referential, because it's very hard to escape, you know, the approach of, well, where is Rooney in her work? And to write about what she knows, well, this is what she knows. You know, she's talked about before about the worlds that she creates out of, you know, her own experiences. And of course, being a young woman thrust into the limelight so suddenly as a writer and having to navigate this space is something that she knows quite a lot about. And of course, that bubbles up then in Alice and Eileen's exchange. They write very intense, very long emails back and forth to each other. Both of them are also quite fragile, and they are very, they're seeking. They are looking for something. They are both very dissatisfied with their lives. Alice has no time for celebrity. She sees it as something of a trap, something she's trying to cast off to such an extent that she's not even sure that she's going to write something in our new novel. You know, so there is a real you can certainly draw those. You can draw those comparisons. But I also think, to be fair, that, you know, this question of the way that celebrity functions in contemporary society has been posed before, and whether Rooney is writing about it or not, it is a very urgent question that needs to be asked.
And it's very important to say here, yes, of course there are parallels in that Alice, the lead character, or one of the lead characters here, is a writer, and Eileen is an editor. Both of those professional sides to Sally Rooney's life, obvious crossover there. But you mentioned how fractured they both are, and how, you know, their own lives are, to say the very least, in a little bit of trouble. Sally Rooney is very private about her private life, and that is absolutely her right, and anything she has said about it is very positive in terms of her familial support and in terms of her own marital status, you know. So it's rather facile to think, oh well, she's writing about herself here in terms of the emotions of these characters, whatever about the worlds that they have inhabit.
Yes, and it is very reductionist, and it also does a disservice to the fact as well. And I think what is very interesting about Beautiful World, Where Are You? I think it is, John, her most political novel to date. And what I mean by that is she's looking, I think, very much at this kind of millennial malaise that is, very present in the culture at the moment, this kind of nihilism and questioning about what direction life is supposed to go for this generation, who are going to be, the first in a very, very long time to not succeed materially as their parents' generation. You know, the planet is dying. She describes Dublin kind of as a city that's slowly emptying out. You know, Eileen's based there, and she's going to parties, and she's feeling, living in a horrible apartment, her friends are emigrating, and there's just this sense of being stuck. And, you know, her first two novels were based very much in the college experience. These characters are approaching their 30s. The game is changing, and it's that moving forward, really, you know, trying to cast off this stretching adolescence that they've had and move into some kind of future that feels satisfying, that has this beauty that she talks about that I think is really, really important, the sense of connection and wonder in the world that the characters are trying to find. And it is so, so hard because of the nature of the moment that we find ourselves in.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the relationships then that both Alice and Eileen find themselves in. The biggest relationship, in fact, in the novel is between Alice and Eileen and those series of emails. And we might come back to some of the stuff that's discussed in those emails. But tell me a little bit about the relationship that develops and that is there between Alice and Felix, who's this, Alice being the writer, and Felix is this fella up in the west of Ireland where Alice has decamped to as the novel starts. He works in a local warehouse.
Yes, and he's kind of a prickly character, it has to be said. And they meet via a dating app, and they're on in this coastal town in Mayo. And there's an immediate connection there. What that connection is, we're not too sure initially, and I don't think Alex or Felix are necessarily too sure initially. But they hit it off. We get the impression that they're both quite lonely, and obviously Alice is in a vulnerable state, having had quite a serious mental breakdown. She's not sure where she's headed with her career, and she's as you said, relocated to this house in Mayo. So they have this connection. She, as you do, invites him to go to Rome initially with her, where she's going on to do some work around her career, and he goes with her. And from there, they kind of, well, it's an interesting relationship. I'll say that there, I wouldn't be Felix's biggest fan. Let's just say that I think he can be quite a cruel character. But perhaps that's part of the element of what draws Alice to him.
Yeah, but in some ways, they bring out both the best and the worst in each other. There's a little bit of both things going on there. And what about the other heterosexual relationship then that we have, which is between Simon and Eileen?
Yes, in the grand tradition of Rooney's will they, won't they pairings, we have Simon and Eileen, who have known each other since Eileen was born, since they were very little. They've been neighbours, and Eileen has always had something of an attraction to Simon. They are adults now, and things are complicated. Eileen is pining for an ex of hers. She relies on Simon for a lot of her kind of emotional needs, and he's very fond of her. They keep in touch. They occasionally sleep with each other. But of course, the question bubbling underneath all of that is, where is this going to go? Is it going to go anywhere? And what Rooney is so good at, and you see it again and again throughout her work, and this book is no different, is the myriad of ways we self-sabotage when it comes to getting what we want, particularly in love. The misunderstandings, the misreadings, the expectations that aren't met, the fears that we have around connecting. And I mean, that really is at the heart of Eileen and Simon's dance, as it were, around what it is they do and do not want, and whether that involves each other.
And who can forget the furore that was around Normal People, and particularly the television series and the sex scenes in it? There's plenty of sex in this novel. How well or how badly does Sally Rooney write sex in your mind, Mary?
I think she writes sex brilliantly, Sean, and that's not, that's a very, very hard thing to do. It's really hard to write sex that doesn't come across as smutty or, preachy or silly, that makes you kind of laugh. You can't take it seriously. There's something deeply intimate and erotic about the way she depicts sex, and what it is refreshingly free of, particularly given the context of Ireland, is any sense of shame. And what I was really struck by reading Beautiful World, Where Are You, is that often the characters are best at communicating what it is they want and need from each other when they're having sex, and then suddenly outside of the bedroom it can become so much more complicated again. And I think that's a really interesting contrast, that arises again and again in her work.
Lots of what you're talking about so far is pretty much things that you love about the novel. It strikes me, apart from clearly the character of Felix who annoyed you.
Not a fan.
No, you're not a fan of him. Where does it perhaps do you think Sally Rooney doesn't succeed in this novel? You've given us lots of areas where she succeeds.
I think if readers are coming to this novel expecting something new in terms of, Rooney and the Rooney catalogue, as it were, they're probably going to be disappointed. If they come, in terms of the newness on offer, if they come looking for more of conversations with friends or normal people and the dynamics and atmosphere that kind of define those novels, they will find an awful lot here to enjoy. I think some of the writing in this as well, some of the prose sections where she's describing things, is absolutely exquisite. And I find myself wondering, her time spent screenwriting, we'll say, on Normal People, how that has filtered through the experience of writing a novel. So look, if you're looking for something groundbreaking in terms of how Rooney delivers her work, you perhaps will be disappointed, but I think fans will definitely find a lot to enjoy here.
But what about the discussions that take place in those email passages? Mm. Is this a new area for, I know the characters in the other novels often have conversations about matters philosophical, but these emails at times are very long, very detailed, theorists mentioned, cultural theorists mentioned, philosophers mentioned along the way as well. Do those sections work for you? Do they bring something new to the writing?
They did. And what they brought to the writing for me was a real sense of a deep engagement with the culture and questions that are reverberating at the moment around the question of meaning. I think, Sean, one of the biggest questions of our time is, where do we find meaning during an era when atomization and individuality are on steroids? And I think that question, yes, it very much is to the fore in Alice and Eileen's exchanges, but it is the central theme to the whole novel. And it is that sense of, you know, being alive at a time when the future is so uncertain and people are trying to find meaning and find direction. Young people who are sensing that the plan, as it were, from previous generations is just not available to them anymore. And I think one thing that's interesting in this book as well, and I think it's going to be much remarked upon, is Rooney's approach to religion and the place of religion and what religion offers. And I don't necessarily mean in an ideological sense. I mean in a deeply spiritual sense.
Yeah, talk to us a little bit. It's Simon, the character who's involved with Eileen being the editor character. Simon is involved with her, and he's much is made of his religious beliefs and the fact that he attends Mass even after he has been committing what would be referred to as mortal sins in some areas.
Indeed.
In extramarital sex, etc., and other things that he's involved in. How does Rooney handle that discourse around religion?
I think very well. And again, what I mean by that is, if you think about tapping into wider questions of the religious impulse in the culture, like, for example, the religious impulse that drives a lot of what we might call cancel culture, right? This push towards purity and morality and these things. Now, that's not how she uses the notion of religion. If you take Simon, for example, initially, you know, yeah, you're absolutely right. The characters kind of are a bit wary of his practicing Catholicism and going to Mass. And of course, you know, he would have been laughed at a bit as a young man for being, we'll say, something of a holy Joe. But as they themselves have grown up, I mean, Alice talks about while she was in hospital for her mental breakdown, reading the Bible, for just as an example, they, in questioning the need for meaning and beauty in their own lives, they begin to kind of look to Simon as someone who seems to be quite together and seems to be a good person. And they ask, how is that connected to his faith? And of course, Simon is very open-minded. He is very much an a la carte Catholic. And you do get a real sense that whatever his religious practice means to him, it does allow him and give him something that it means he can access this kind of, I suppose, spirituality, reverence, connectedness to something beyond himself that I think all of the characters in this book are looking for on some level of belonging, community, and things that are very hard for millennials to actually secure now because life has become so precarious.
And the other part of, I suppose, a sense of community, one could argue, is Sally Rooney, his own, a convinced Marxist and has always espoused such beliefs. Alice in this book talks about, you know, making loads of money from her writing, and she defends the making of that money and she holds on to a Marxist viewpoint as well.
Yes, but I suppose the thing to remember, Sean, is that, you know, and they talk about this in relation to the awfulness of consumer society. I think it's Alice that says, you know, she's standing, perhaps it's Eileen, but they're standing queuing for their lunch in Dublin, and they look around at all these pre-packaged foods and they realise how much labour, exploited labour, has gone into to making this abundance that they get to choose from. But then they say, you know, I have to buy my lunch. And this is the nature of capitalism and these systems that we find ourselves within. It's almost impossible to extract yourself from them. So, you know,
is that a good enough argument, though? You know, the two each according to his or her ability or talent, if you like. So you got loads of talent, you make loads of money, but two each according to his or her need. Then, do we get that side of the Marxist argument? Is that expanded out for us in any way?
Oh, I think so. I think that is one of the central conflicts of the whole book, is like, how is any of this fair, and how can anybody expect to be happy and free knowing that other people are so unhappy and so not free? And what is one to do with this? And, you know, Rooney doesn't offer any simple solutions, and she doesn't let anybody off the hook. But what she does do, and I think this is worth holding on to, and when she does it, you know, sometimes I have to say, it just took my breath away. The prose was really, really beautiful. She points points to the simple abundance of everyday life that has nothing to do with money or status. And I may sound incredibly cheesy saying this, and you know, and just in the same way that, you know, writing books about love may be seen as incredibly cheesy, doesn't mean it's not true, and it doesn't mean that it's not profound, and that it doesn't tap into something that resonates deeply with us as human beings. And I think that a lot of millennials are really struggling to try and access at the moment.
Lots of the publicity material, certainly that I read, has, you know, her greatest, quoting reviews that say her greatest novel to date. Well, they're hardly going to quote the ones that say something different to us, are they? But where does Beautiful World, Where Are You sit for you, Mary, in comparison to Conversations with Friends and Normal People?
I enjoyed Conversations with Friends. I absolutely adored Normal People, and I enjoyed Beautiful World, Where Are You? So for me, it's not quite up there with Normal People, but definitely on par with Conversations with Friends. And I think, look, for Rooney fans out there, they will not be disappointed. For people who come to the party looking to be disappointed, I'm sure they will find something to be disappointed about.
All right. So it's a recommendation from you, Mary, without putting words in your mouth, is it?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely a recommendation. And I look forward to seeing how the discourse will run in the weeks and months ahead about this new one.
All right. That's Mary McGill speaking to us about Sally Rooney's latest novel, Beautiful World, Where Are You?, which is published by Faber and Faber. And that publication takes place tomorrow. 27 minutes past 7 on Monday night's Arena. The 78th Venice Film Festival opened last week, September the 1st, continues through until this Saturday, September the 11th. Amongst the most talked about films featured at the festival are Denis Villeneuve's remake of the David Lynch sci-fi classic Dune, Paul Schrader penned The Card Counter, and Jim Campion's latest film, The Power of the Dog, featuring a quite full-on and seemingly very nasty performance from Benedict Cumberbatch. Tara Brady has been at the festival and has picked out some of the highlights for us here on Arena. And it's always a problem where to start with something like this, but we'll start with the festival itself, Tara, and those mm-hmm. who had attended. Who was there, who was grabbing the headlines, and why?
Well, everyone was there. I mean, bear in mind, this was the only major festival to go ahead last year, so it wasn't a big surprise that it went ahead last year. This year, now that everything is reopening, it wasn't quite as strict as Cannes. If you remember Cannes, every 48 hours you had to have your PCR test, but you did need your vaccination cert. And as with all the kind of museums and galleries and open places in Venice, your temperature is checked on the way in to the cinemas and into the campus. Last year's event was obviously quite, you know, closed off, and there was a lot of social distancing. So this one was really big, you know, big bangs back on the red carpet, and the big statement outfits were all back. There was lots of chatter around Kirsten Stewart's all black hot pants Chanel suit, which looked rather fabulous. And there was then kind of the wrong kind of talk around Rebecca Ferguson's Dior dress, a frock, which was probably a bad day for everyone at the fashion office. It looked like they sort of shot a wad of tulle at her with a cannon, and she must have missed that, wished that they'd missed. So it felt very much like everything, a little bit like Cannes, an extension of Cannes. It felt very much like everything was back in business.
Oh, the big anticipation, I think, was around Dune, $160 million plus sci-fi remake of from Denis Villeneuve here, one of the most anticipated. But I think really for you, it was, as much as it was the Venice Film Festival, it was the Oscar Isaac Film Festival. He was all over the place, including in Dune.
I spent almost as much time with Oscar Isaac as I did with the mosquitoes, and I've got mosquito bites everywhere. I've got mosquito bites on my face even. My first day there was almost entirely Oscar Isaac, and you know, which is strange because I've spent kind of months and, you know, even a couple of years wondering, you know, where the heck is Oscar Isaac? He hasn't really been on the screen all that much. He was the star of my first film that I saw at Venice, which is The Card Counter, a really terrific new film from Paul Schrader, produced by his old buddy Martin Scorsese, and starring Isaac as a soldier turned poker star who has learned to count cards during a really significant spell in jail for his part in the American torture regimes at Guantanamo Bay and other American black ops sites. You know, as ever with Schrader, who was raised Calvinist and who revisits these spiritual themes all the time, it's a big tale of spiritual redemption, but it's one that requires absolute horrors to get to the spiritual redemption. And speaking of horrors, then I had to watch all 5 hours of Oscar Isaac. Affleck and Jessica Chastain's marriage falling apart. Right, well, Scenes from a Marriage.
Yeah, I'll come back to Scenes from a Marriage, but I want to stick with the card counter just for a moment. Tell me a little bit more about his relationship, first of all, with his agent. This is the William Tell is the character played by Oscar Isaac. His relationship with that, with his agent, first of all, and this kid that he comes across on the poker circuit, a guy called, the character's called Kirk, I believe.
Yeah, so he becomes this kind of parental figure to this kid that latches on to him. The kid's father has committed suicide, and the father was also involved in the same kind of shady regimes or shady business that Oscar Isaac's character was. But yeah, there's this very interesting relationship with this kind of agent. And bear in mind, you know, we say agent, but it's such a kind of shadowy kind of world, the whole poker world that's explored. Everything is at night, you know, you're not too sure how official everything is and above board everything is. But played by Tiffany Haddish. You know, Tiffany Haddish is someone who is obviously best known for her comedy roles, but you know, we saw her opposite Billy Crystal just last week in a new film, and she does seem to be really proving her worth as a dramatic prospect, and she's certainly able to go toe to toe with Oscar Isaac, who, you know, many regard as one of the great actors of his generation.
No mean feat to go toe to toe with him, for sure. Let's have a listen to a clip featuring Isaac then as William Tell speaking to La Linda, I believe is the name of the character, played by Tiffany Haddish, and they're talking about that kid that William Tell has come across on the poker circuit.
I wish the kid had been here.
Well, let me call him.
No, it's all right. Leave him alone.
You know you made the cut. This is your moment.
You know, I think that you have the wrong idea about me. Yes, I want to win the money. I want to go to the World Series, but then that's it. This kid, Kirk, he needs help. He's got financial debts. And I understand him. If I can help him, maybe he has a chance to start over again, resume his education, and start a life.
And you would do all that?
Well, yeah. Yeah.
You have to be the strangest poker player I ever met.
Oh, you have no idea.
There you go. That's a scene from The Card Counter, Oscar Isaac and Tiffany Haddish there. Film opened at the 70th Venice Film Festival. Tara Brady was there and she's speaking with us this evening. What interested me also about this film is at one level, you know, kind of Robin Hood story that's in there. Guy comes and he looks after the poor kid who's out on the poker scene. But there's a whole political under story that seems to be running alongside this about William Tell, the Oscar Isaac character, about his past, Tara.
Yeah, there is, which we see in these kind of very nightmarish flashbacks, this kind of snaking, circling camera. There's also this another shadowy figure in his past, his superior officer, who's played by Willem Dafoe. And Willem Dafoe, as you know, can be very sinister on screen when he wants to be. And then that's counterpointed with Ty Sheridan's Kirk character, who, you know, has a choice to make as to whether or not he wants to pursue Willem Dafoe, who he blames for his father's death, or whether or not he wants to stick with Isaac, Oscar Isaac, out on the road and form a new life for himself away from revenge. But yeah, so the gambling sort of motif, if you like, sort of carries over into every aspect of the story.
Let's have a listen to Isaac again then, reminiscing about the crimes he and his fellow soldiers perpetrated against prisoners at Abu Ghraib.
And am I trying to justify what we did? No. Nothing. Nothing can justify what we did. Your father understood that. If you were there, you could understand. Otherwise, there's no understanding.
Oscar Isaac there in the card counter, and Tara, that gives us a sense, I suppose, about why he is considered one of the best actors of his generation. Mm-hmm. Even in 37 seconds there, he gets quite a lot into that. You were saying that you had to sit through 5 hours, however. Did you sit through the full 5 hours of Jessica Chastain and Oscar Isaac in Scenes from a Marriage?
I did indeed, and it didn't. I did. I got a break halfway through. After they give you, there was a break between parts one and two, and then three, four, and five. But yeah, by the end, I felt like I was getting a divorce from Oscar Isaac. This is a big new series from HBO, and this is a big new trend at the big festivals as well.
I was going to say this is a TV show that's been premiered at a film festival.
Precisely. But I think, well, it's a measure of how much the traditional kind of theatrical models and the streaming models are colliding. And bear in mind, Jane Campion's new film, Power of the Dog, that's a Netflix release. And remember, a few years ago, that was where David Lynch unveiled the most recent Twin Peaks. So this project was developed and written and directed by Hagai Levi, who directed and produced In Treatment for HBO. So he already has that track record with big, you know, sort of starry, much admired, well-reviewed TV series. It's an English language, it has great pedigree. It's an English language remake of the 1973 Swedish miniseries of the same name by Ingmar Bergman. And it's obviously a big acting showcase. Both Chastain and Isaac produced, and you can see why. It's an absolute great piece for them. There's so much work for an actor to do. For four out of the five episodes, I think it's pretty great. I think they take a sort of change of tone in the final episode that steers it away from the Bergman original that doesn't quite work as a gamble. And also I think what's interesting about it is that instead of Bergman's sort of existential Swedish dread, they speak to each other very often in that kind of fluent therapy speak, and you just wish they'd scream or smash crockery or something, because it's almost more violent the way they keep talking to each other and articulating about how you feel.
Right, let's have a listen to the pair of them then, Jessica Chastain and Oscar Isaac in Scenes from a Marriage.
I mean, you remember those first 2 years with Ava, thinking about jumping back into that nightmare.
Yeah, I was there too, I remember.
I know you were. I know, you've been an amazing partner. But you couldn't, like...
I couldn't no, be where you were. I couldn't be in your place.
You tried and... But you couldn't. I took that out on you. It was just awful to you. It was awful.
We talked about it, and I understood where that came from.
You understood, but you were also hurt.
Oh, yeah, I see what you mean about therapy talk. Okay. Jessica Chastain and Oscar Isaac there in Scenes from a Marriage. So the 5-part miniseries showing at the Venice Film Festival. Tara Brady speaking to us about the festival this evening. And I suppose it is part of that whole thing too, that the demarcation line between television and film now is not quite what it used to be.
No, definitely not. And you see that with the amount of sort of big name projects and big name director and big name stars that are signing on for this kind of project. I mean, it's a really logical thing for Chastain and Isaac to do. They're very old friends. I think they went to college together, and they've also done other projects together, like in Most Dangerous Year, going a few years back, and they obviously get along very well. Though you just wonder how you're gonna there's a lot of very very intimate scenes, so it must have been slightly awkward going for chips or whatever afterwards at the end of the day. It's interesting as well. It's obviously a very post marriage story project. You wonder how much of it was motivated by Marriage Story going on Netflix too, and like Marriage Story, Chastain's character comes out sort of the worst, like the woman comes off slightly the worst, but Chastain has fun doing that. She has fun articulating all the kind of horrible aspects of her character, and then there's this kind of foregrounding of the fact that it's an acting piece. You see people in masks, and you see the production setup at the beginning of every episode, so you'll see Oscar arriving on set or Jessica arriving on set, and then just getting into the part, so they're very much kind of foregrounding all the kind of acting muscles that they've had to use, if you like.
Yeah, we were speaking about Sally Rooney's new novel, Beautiful World, Where Are You, earlier on. And Paul Mescal, of course, of Normal People fame, is the significant Irish interest in the film that he's involved in, alongside Jessie Buckley. The Lost Daughter. Yeah. Did you see this? How did they fare? How did that get on?
Yeah, no, Lost Daughter is a very interesting project. It's Maggie Gyllenhaal's directorial debut. And it stars Olivia Colman as a comparative literature professor on holiday who was in flashbacks, it's revealed, had a very difficult time when she was a young mother, and something that she starts to recall when she meets Dakota Johnson's character, who's another young woman having a difficult time as a mother. There's two big Irish presences in the film. Jessie Buckley, who's thankfully becoming increasingly ubiquitous and who's always excellent to watch. She plays the younger Olivia Colman. And then we have Paul Mescal, who plays this sort of pool boy beach resort attendant who goes out drinking with Olivia Colman on one occasion, but who turns out to have a slightly different role than we were expecting later on in the film. As that probably suggests, Jessie Buckley is actually playing an English character. There are a lot of American characters in the film, for some reason Ed Harris is this kind of Airbnb manager in the middle of this Greek island. So there's a lot of competing accents, and there's a lot of competing strands, and there's a lot of competing parallel stories. It doesn't quite all gel together into a kind of pleasingly shaped movie, but there's plenty of big moments and big performances.
Well, let's go to the one that I was talking about as being the most anticipated, certainly Dune. Denis Villeneuve, director of Sicario, former sci-fi movies, obviously Arrival in 2016, Blade Runner 2049 2017. So this is the first of two movies, this new one, Dune, the first of two movies adapting Frank Herbert's 1965 novel of the same name.
Well, we think so. That very much depends on
how it does.
Because bear in mind, Denis Villeneuve has been down this road before. He made the Blade Runner sequel. If you remember, it got terrific reviews. Absolute rave reviews. People calling it the cinematic experience of a lifetime. And it was a sizable box office flop. I mean, it lost a lot of money for Sony. This film again is going. It's been delayed because of COVID, but it's still, a big gamble for Warner Brothers. Worth mentioning, of course, there's more Oscar Isaac in this one. It's an absolutely fabulous looking
thing. What a cast!
Yeah. Like an extraordinary cast. That's kind of part of the issue is that. As you know, with the novel, it's very much an exercise in world building. There's this huge religious story, there's this political story, and there's an awful lot of politics to get your head around. And really, this is very much a part one. It's just building everything up and getting to the point where it needs to be before they actually get into the kind of meat of the movie. With reference to David Lynch. Lynch's earlier Dune film, we're not even up to Sting by the end of the film. Right. So that's as far as we've got in the rather sizable book. And it's a fabulous looking thing. It at times it's a bit like being trapped in a kind of 3-hour perfume commercial. Because it's so sort of stylish looking. And an awful lot of the film is given over to exposition. We get sort of voiceover. We get these little holographic school lessons that Timothée Chalamet's character is studying. We get sort of mansplaining and woman-splaining and Zendaya-splaining a lot of the time, and we get intertitles and voiceover and all these things just to kind of lay out and so we can figure out everything that's going
and
on
how is,
in the world of
Dune. How is Timothée managing in here? Timothée Chalamet, he's playing the Duke of the Big House here.
Well, at the risk of getting pelted by rotten fruit on the street by Timothée's legion of very, very, very fond fans, he's one of those guys who's a very natural screen presence. So he does contemporary a lot better than he does period. And having big kind of chunks of sci-fi doesn't necessarily always sit well with him. It's a little bit of a flatter turn than, say, somebody like Oscar Isaac puts in. And there's an additional issue that there's not great chemistry between him and Rebecca Ferguson, Jackson, who's playing his mother, and they're just a little bit flat together. Just the chemistry isn't quite right. The family chemistry isn't right. That may be because the poor woman's only about 15 minutes older than him, so it's not going to be that kind of
odd
big
casting
maternal
to have her,
feel.
As his mother. All right, Oscar Isaac, Timothy Chalamet, Rebecca Ferguson, Josh Brolin, Stellan Skarsgård. Yeah, quite a Charlotte Rampling in there as well. The Power of the Dog, Benedict Cumberbatch in here. This is from piano director Jane Campion.
Mm-hmm.
You believe that this is one of the strongest contenders for a prize winner from the festival. Why?
Well, as you and not just this festival, as you know, Venice in recent years, with the exception of Parasite, which won Cannes, Venice in recent years has become the big Oscar predictor. And that goes back to Shape of Water, which first won Best Film at Venice and then went on to win Best Film at the Academy Awards. And that happened again last year with Nomadland, won Best Film at Venice, then went on to win Best Film and Best Director at the Academy Awards. You have to think that Power of the Dog will very likely do the same. Well, that would be my prediction anyway. It could go the other way. The Venice jury this year is headed by Parasite director Bong Joon-ho, who may be keen to reward someone like Pedro Almodovar, whose new film Parallel Mothers premiered at the festival and who amazingly has never won the big prize at Venice, Cannes or Berlin, the big three festivals. But Power of the Dog is going to be, a tough act to beat. It's Jane Campion's best film from since An Angel at My Table. It has stars Cumberbatch is probably one of the meanest characters I've ever seen on screen. He actually punches a horse while calling the poor animal a flat-faced bitch at one point, and he likes horses. So you can imagine how mean he is to people. He plays Phil, one of two rancher brothers in Montana in 1925. The other is George, played by affable Jesse Plemons, who marries Kirsten Dunst in the film, is obviously and who is married to Kirsten Dunst in real life. She's denigrated as a suicide widow by Phil, and her son is bullied by Phil. The son is played a medical student who's played by Cody Smith McPhee, who's slowly emerging as one of the great new stars of cinema, even though he's been around for a very long time in cinema because he was a child actor. So Phil's bullying soon drives Kirsten Dunst's character to drink, but Phil's a secret, which becomes more and more apparent as the film rolls on. This is a really big muscular drama. The cinematography is amazing. It has this amazing score by Johnny Greenwood.
Yeah, really.
I suspect it's going to be a very tough act to beat this year.
Spencer,
Netflix production and due on Netflix on December 1st.
Great. Okay. Well, listen. Just as we finish up, then news broke this afternoon that the legendary film actor Jean-Paul Belmondo died at the age of 88. Shot to international fame after starring in Jean-Luc Godard's revolutionary classic *Abou de Souffle* or *Breathless*. Just give us a sense of his place, Belmondo's place in the story of French cinema, Tara.
Well, it's very, it's very hard to say about somebody like Jean-Paul Belmondo that they're a huge loss of cinema because they haven't been part of cinema, an active part of cinema in a great many years. His last film was in 2009, and even that was an outlier, A Man and His Dog. Like he was mostly doing theatres by the time the 90s came along, save for around 95 when he was in a version of Les Miserables and in Agnès Varda's 101 Nights. He's, in the 70s, he was kind of a big action star, and even in the late 60s, a big action star of kind of like fun, adventurous, like French Indiana Jones type films like that or serial films like That Man from Rio. And that was those were the kind of films he liked himself. He always said his favorite, fictional character was Tintin and that's where his taste lie. But really, he's best known for much more highfalutin films with this, and in particular, the collaborations he had, his presence in the Nouvelle Vague cinema and the collaborations he had with Jean-Luc Godard. Like Breathless and Pierre Le Fou and films like that, and Femme est une Femme. I was really shocked when I was reading various obituaries today to find out that the New York Times review of Breathless called him hypnotically ugly, because I've always thought of him as the kind of classic Gallic handsome. Right. He was part, his grandfather was Italian, he had that kind of classic Roman nose, and he had such a presence on screen. And you watch him even now, and it's just absolutely mesmerizing in films. films like Little Soldier.
Right. Well, let's finish up with the Jean-Luc Godard, A Bout de Souffle, or Breathless, that you mentioned there. He's playing petty thief Michelle in this, romances his American girlfriend Patricia, played by Jean Seidenberg. She's out selling newspapers on the street. He wants her to go to Rome with him. Just listen to them as much as anything and let it wash over you.
New York Herald Tribune!
Est-ce que tu m'accompagnes à Rome? Oui, c'est idiot, je t'aime. Je voulais te revoir pour savoir si te revoir me ferait plaisir.
Vous venez d'où? Monte Carlo?
Non, de Marseille. Je suis resté samedi et dimanche à Monte Carlo. Fallait que je voie un type. Lundi, j'ai essayé de t'appeler de Marseille.
Lundi et dimanche, t'es pas à Paris. New York Herald Tribune!
Je t'en prends un.
Qu'est-ce que vous faites ici? C'est que vous détestez Perry.
J'ai pas dit que je détestais, j'ai dit que j'avais beaucoup d'ennemis.
Alors vous êtes en danger?
Oui, je suis en danger. Tu veux pas venir à Rome avec moi, Patricia?
Et faire quoi là-bas?
On verra.
Non, j'ai beaucoup de choses à faire à Perry, Michel.
Et maintenant, qu'est-ce que tu fais? Tu remontes ou tu descends les Champs?
Qu'est-ce que c'est les Champs?
Les Champs-Élysées. Ouais, il faut que j'aille à Avenue Georges V.
Ok, je vous laisse.
Allez, remonte avec moi.
Jusqu'à la rue alors. New York Herald Tribune.
Just before you go, Tara Brady, there we are remembering Belmondo, who died today, the Paul, Jean-Paul Belmondo, the actor. Spencer, I thought you were telling me about that at one stage there, but this is the latest screen offering to capitalise on the fascination with Diana Spencer, Princess Diana from 1981. Johnny Greenwood in here and Kirsten Stewart in here as well. Yes. Tell us about her, first of all.
It's a really fascinating performance. Like, as you know, with biopics in recent years, like, people tend to do interpretation rather than an exact impersonation. Rather than a dead-on impersonation, if you think about Rami Malek in Bohemian Rhapsody or Joaquin Phoenix in Walk the Line, and Kirsten Stewart goes absolutely the other way. She is doing an absolute impersonation, like the hair, the voice, the look up that she did during that famous interview. She's doing everything Diana. Right. And it's a film that's really way out there on a limb, very imaginative, quite like his Portrait of Jackie Kennedy.
Looking forward to seeing that when it makes its way to the cinemas then. So lots of excitement from Tara Brady there, and the 70th Venice Film Festival runs until this Saturday, September the 11th. A new initiative in the arts will bring poetry into towns all over Ireland. Poetry Ireland's Poetry Town will see 20 poets working in 20 towns right around the country. These poets or poet laureates are either from the local area or have a strong connection with it, having been commissioned to write a poem honouring and reflecting the town and the people of that town. Joined by two of those laureates, Vincent Woods and Grace Wells, representing Carrick on Shannon, County Leitrim, and Ennis Diamond, County Clare, respectively. Welcome to both of you. Vincent, your connection with Carrick on Shannon goes back quite a way.
Goes back a long way, Sean. I grew up about sort of 20 miles further north, but I spent a lot of my youth knocking around Carrick, saw some of my first films in the cinema there, the old Gaiety Cinema, danced at many a carnival, went to regattas, had great fun in Carrick. And it was also the county town, so it was the administrative capital of the county. It's where you went for grants, where you went for important business. The train took you away from Carrick to Dublin and back. So I made a lot of journeys, important journeys in my time and out of Carrick.
And despite the fact that a lot of your life has been in and around Dublin, and a lot of your work, you know, that you did both as a broadcaster and as a poet and as a playwright, you were based in Dublin for lots of that. But the connection with Leitrim is huge.
Oh, it is. I mean, that's the well. That's where I go back to. Mm. And so it was great to have this opportunity to step back into Carrick and Shannon as a town that I thought I knew. You know, I worked there every year. I spent a good deal of time. But it's different when you actually have a commission like this. To, you know, you look more deeply. You look behind things. And it's like mapping a place anew. And, you know, delving back into the history. David Thompson's great book Woodbrook is a marvellous account of that locality and its hard history, and it is a hard history. And it was very good to delve into that again and walk the streets with that in mind and look. I mean, the Shannon, the river defines the town. You know, Carrick and Shannon is the name in English, but it's actually Corridor Marush in Irish, which is the weir of the marshy ridge. So it's a watery town, and it's the hardness is built around that. Fascinating history. great challenge to write a poem about it.
For sure. And let's go to Grace Wells then, who's in our Galway studio. Your town, Grace, is Ennis Diamond in North Clare. What about your connection with Clare? How far back does that go?
Well, it's only 3 years old, really. I moved to Ennis Diamond 3 years ago. Before that, I was living in County Tipperary for 30 years.
And how difficult is it then, you know, because I'm thinking of Vincent and in terms of the long connection he has with Carrick on Shannon and with Leitrim. For you, how difficult is it when there's something very new like that? I think sometimes maybe that gives you a fresh eye that somebody who has a big connection mightn't have.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Ennis Diamond is an amazing place just at the moment anyway. Everything is new. Every day is new. There's a whole kind of new world happening all the time that's blending the old world. A lot of young people, a lot of young families, a lot of young cafes, young bookshops. There's a lot of young things happening. So it feels quite natural to have only been there for 3 years because I'm one of many people who've only been there for 3 years. And although, you know, you don't want to say the wrong thing because there are people who've been there for several hundred years, it kind of fits to have somebody who hasn't been there that long because a lot of the community hasn't been there very long. And this sort of renewing, this endlessly each day renewing feeling kind of fits with someone who hasn't been there.
Although, Vincent, I suppose in some ways you had that challenge of when you have a long connection with it, it can't just be lovely florid language about Carrick and Shannon, the beautiful place, and everything is perfect in Carrick and Shannon. Nothing is perfect anywhere.
No, not at all. And that is absolutely, Sean, a bigger challenge because also you're known in a town. So when you're looking into it, it's dodgy territory potentially, but you know, as it's not a popularity contest. It, you know, Carrick carries its history. We know it now as this kind of modern town associated with stags and hens, celebrations, fun times, and all of that is there. And but side by side with that is the older history. Carrick had one of the biggest workhouses in Ireland, for instance. So a big history of deportations from there. The what were called the Earl Grey girls were sent off to Australia from the workhouse. Evictions, hard history, and you can't get away from that. The famine grey, anyone going to Carrick, you know, might well take a wander up the town to the Attic Famine Museum, where you actually, the part of the old workhouse is retained. You can stand where people slept on that big floor.
So important, I guess, not to be afraid to go to those. You can't ignore the dark side of things. Was that a challenge for you as well, Grace, that, you know, it's all very well to give us a lovely poem about a lovely place, but you do have to look at some of the difficult aspects of the past as well, because your poem deals with the past and the present around Ennis Diamond.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, one of the constraints of the project is that we were asked to write a poem that was only 30 lines long. So I did that, and now I've spilled over and I'm writing another poem, which is more like 20 pages long, because you can't really contain a town in 30 lines. And yeah, the past is so present in the buildings, in the fabric of the town, the streets, the layout, that you just can't ignore it.
Yeah.
And the history of Ennis Diamond is like a microcosm of the history of Ireland. So, yeah, indeed, all
you
of those things.
You can't run away from it. Now, quite rightly, we can't hear either of the poems that you have both written for the various towns, because the first people to hear those poems will be the people of the towns themselves. That's the way it should be. But maybe, Vincent, you could share us something about a poem about Leitrim that you have.
Absolutely, Sean. Again, this poem, an old poem of mine, The Road West, in a sense skirts around Carrick and Shannon. It's a journey into some of the other towns, a journey in history, putting back into English some of the old place names in Irish. From the back of the old cow, we went west. By nightfall, we were asleep at the mouth of the big space. The sun rose yellow in sight of the holy wood. There were swallows gathering over the beautiful rock. If we had gone north, as we often did, to camp in the place of sanctuary, we might have met the soldiers leaving the ridge of the rowan tree. We might have gone as far as the hill of the two air demons to warn someone. But we went west, away from history. We were not there as witnesses to change.
And Grace, maybe you would give us just a short section from one of the poems that you chose around County Clare.
Yeah, so I'll start into Sea Swimmers and you might stop me. The leaves turn yellow, the blackberries ripen, and folk come from town with baskets. Children with purpled fingers catch at the sycamore keys whirling down, and day after day the women keep on swimming, elongating summer, stretching its sweetness like elastic, streeling out its days to return like seals to the rocks at Clahan and the beach at Lahinch and White Strand swimming hole, to plunge themselves into sky and ocean, to shiver afterwards in the raw air, eking out summer, even as October fades into November's swift dark. They are still quivering wet, clinging on like the last leaves, as if the women of the West were amphibious, built for more than just the gravity of land, until even they must at last surrender and swim back upriver to the winter hearth.
Nowhere to stop you in the midst of that. It's one big long flow. Sea Swimmers, a poem there about County Clare from Grace Wells. And before that, you heard Vincent Woods reading his poem about a previous poem about Carrick and Shannon, County Leitrim. And we look forward to hearing the two poems around Poetry Ireland's Poetry Town event, which will see 20 poets working in 20 towns right around the country. And that will be shared. Those will be shared with us in the coming days and weeks. But that is our lot for this evening. Evening, Leah Murphy researched, Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator, Damien Chanel was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan.